wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, Francis was joined by AUT Professor Marcus Jones, where they talked about the effectiveness of COVID vaccines against the Delta variant, massive volcanoes cooling the earth, and the genetic pattern which offers clues to the evolution of homosexuality. Here they are now.
So let's begin with this waning effectiveness of COVID vaccines against Delta. Tell me about that.
Okay, yeah. So the Delta variant has obviously caused a lot of issues around the world because it seems to be a lot more infectious than previous variants. And we are obviously seeing the effects of that now in New Zealand with the current outbreak. A study or preprint actually just came out of, I think, Oxford, studying the Pfizer vaccine and also the AstraZeneca vaccine to see how effective they are against the Delta variant and also how their protection drops away over time. And it turns out that they are both pretty effective, the Pfizer one probably more so, but both of their protection does drop away quite significantly over a relatively short period of time. And I sort of hesitate to say this, but this was a study done at Oxford, comparing literally millions of COVID data or of COVID test results, and whether people have been vaccinated or not, and which vaccine that they had. And the vaccine made by Pfizer was 92% effective at keeping people from developing a high viral load. And that was 14 days after the second dose. So that's sort of in line with what we knew or what we thought we knew. But the vaccine's effectiveness fell to 90%, then 85%, and then 78% after 30, 60, and 90 days respectively. So after 90 days, the effectiveness of the vaccine at keeping people from developing a high viral load, in other words, high concentration of virus in their bodies, was 78%. Now that's still pretty high, and it's actually higher than the AstraZeneca vaccine after 14 days. So it's very good, and it shouldn't deter people from getting vaccinated. But it does point at maybe we can tweak the strategy of how we're vaccinating people and with what. And with what technologies we're using to vaccinate people. The AstraZeneca vaccine turned out was only 69% effective against a high viral load 14 days after the second dose, and that fell to 61% after 90 days. But the paper does say the drop in effectiveness shouldn't be a cause for alarm. Both of these vaccines, two doses, are still doing really well against Delta. And that's really the take-home message here.
So we should still get vaccinated.
We should definitely still get vaccinated. There is some idea that once you're vaccinated, you're not going to get infected, but that's not necessarily the case. You can still get infected. It's just that you won't develop a very high viral load, so it's likely that you won't develop serious symptoms. Anyone who thinks that if they get infected, having been vaccinated, they can't transmit, also, that isn't likely to be true. So you can still transmit the virus. And this is just, again, this is why it's really important that we get as many people vaccinated as possible, so that although the vaccine will be in our population eventually, but if we are all vaccinated, then we won't all be going to hospital. We'll be getting maybe a little bit sick, but just not very sick. We can still transmit it, just like you can still transmit the flu if you have the flu vaccine. But it's going to dramatically lessen the impact of the disease.
Yeah? Right. And it's all about reducing our risk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly,
okay. Yeah. Let's move on to these massive volcanoes which could cool the Earth. Tell me about that.
Okay, so we've all seen volcanoes, and there's not much very few forces on Earth more powerful than a large volcanic eruption. And at the most potent, volcanoes inject millions of tons of particles that can block sunlight. Then they inject those high into the atmosphere. And that can cool the Earth, and in some cases for nearly 5 years, endangering crops and leading to sort of years without summer. The most recent major volcanic explosion, which was the Mount Pinatubo explosion in 1991, which was in the Philippines, that caused a temporary half degree C, degree Celsius drop in global temperatures. So that was a measurable drop in temperatures just from one pretty big volcanic eruption. But it's becoming increasingly clear that even these monumental forces are being altered by human-driven climate change. For instance, declining ice cover in Arctic and Antarctic regions can trigger more frequent eruptions near the poles. And also an increasingly layered ocean will allow more volcano-induced cooling to linger at the Earth's surface. And now a recent study suggests that increased greenhouse gases will help the plumes, these big sort of plumes of gases from these large eruptions, reach higher, spread faster, and reflect more sunlight, causing more abrupt and extreme cooling. Now, we're talking about global warming, and this is cooling. Probably inducing volcanoes is not a good way to solve global warming. We don't want more catastrophic events occurring in our atmosphere. So before humanity really started altering our planet, volcanoes were one of the biggest climate players. They were the things that really controlled, you know, changes in the climate. Over the long term, they emitted a lot of carbon dioxide, which caused warming. But in the short term, they also emitted sulfur gases, which reacted with water to form highly reflective particles called sulfates that triggered spells of global cooling. Yeah, and you can see that in ice cores. There's these dark smudged lines in ice cores that give us the best evidence of these of what the weather did and the sort of the reflections caused by these sulfates in prehistory. But the opposite is also true. It turns out the climate can have a big impact on volcanoes. And in this study, some researchers combined computer simulations of volcanic eruptions with a global climate model, and they simulated the response to plumes from sort of medium size and really big volcanoes in historical conditions or in historical climate conditions, and also in sort of worst case conditions that we could experience in about 70, 80 years from now, in about 2100. When the Earth is predicted to have warmed quite rapidly. And the researchers found two sort of opposing countervailing trends. Normally just one or two mid-sized volcanic eruptions shoot through the troposphere. So the atmosphere we talk about in different layers, and one of the lower layers is called the troposphere. And this is where most clouds are formed. This is where there's a lot of turbulence. Above that is the stratosphere. And normally just one or two mid-sized volcanic eruptions shoot through the troposphere each year, bypassing all of sort of the clouds and the Earth weather and reaching the stratosphere, which is much calmer, much drier, which is the level above. And as reflective particles spread through the stratosphere, they cause this spurt of global cooling. But when the troposphere warms, which it's doing at the moment, it expands in height. And eventually that puts the stratosphere out of reach of these eruptions. So it's like if you were playing basketball and suddenly people raised up the hoop, the umpires raised the hoop up a few inches and made it that much harder to score a basket. The story changes with really large volcanoes, though. These really large volcanoes can burst through the troposphere even if the troposphere has been warmed, and their gases would actually eventually reach higher and travel faster in the present climate, amplifying their cooling effect by about 15 or 20%.
Oh wow so
for the mid-sized volcanoes, they're not going to have as big a cooling effect, but the big volcanoes, if they can punch through the troposphere, it turns out that the conditions in the stratosphere are such that the cooling effect, their cooling effect would be magnified. So there's sort of two countervailing things here. Now this is really interesting because it shows the effect of, you know, obviously of volcanoes on global climate, but it's also showing the effect of climate on volcanoes, which is something that you don't normally really think about, how would climate control volcanoes, but it turns out that that's the case. And global warming yet again has some potentially catastrophic effects if we get major eruptions.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a recurring theme.
Oh yes.
And there's
not much
articles.
Good about it. Yes.
No, because we sort of need to set off some giant volcanoes to combat climate change, although that doesn't seem like a very practical
yeah, let's not
solution.
Let's not.
No.
Volcanoes are really good.
Yes, they are. Let's move on to this genetic pattern, which offers clues about the evolution of homosexuality. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I saw this article and I was in two minds whether to talk about it. And I think there's some important issues raised here, and not just by the content of the article. But I'll talk about it, and then maybe we can talk about some of the issues in a moment. So, this is a report on the results of a massive study that finds that genetic markers associated with same-sex encounters might aid reproduction, but some scientists are questioning those conclusions. So, if you talk to an evolutionary biologist, the genetics of homosexuality seems like a bit of a paradox. In theory, humans and other animals who are exclusively attracted to others of the same sex should be unlikely to produce many biological children, so that any genes that predispose people to homosexuality would rarely be passed on to future generations. Seems like that's a very simplistic view. But same-sex attraction is widespread in humans, obviously, and research suggests that it is still partly genetic. So in a study of data from hundreds of thousands of people, some researchers have identified genetic patterns that could be associated with homosexual behavior and show how these might also help people to find different sex or different sex mates and reproduce. The authors say their findings could help explain why genes that predispose people to homosexuality continue to be passed down. But there's a lot of other scientists that are questioning whether these data are really enough to provide any definitive conclusions. These scientists use data from a bunch of different sources, from the UK Biobank, the US National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health, and even the company 23andMe, which a lot of people have used to trace their ancestry, to collect sequenced genome data and information from participants. In total, the team analyzed the genomes of nearly 500,000 people who had said they had had sex at least once with someone of the same sex, and they compared these genomes with those of about 360,000 people who had said they had only had heterosexual sex. So the study only looked at biological sex. It didn't consider gender, and it actively excluded participants whose gender and sex didn't match. In some early research, researchers had found that people who had at least one same-sex partner tended to share patterns of small genetic differences scattered through the genome. But none of these variations seemed to greatly affect sexual behavior on its own, which backed up previous research that found no sign of what you might call a gay gene. There's been no discovery of something like that. But the collection of variants seems to have a small effect overall. So these are lots of different minor differences in genetic people's genetic sequences that seem to have statistically a small effect on people's sexual preferences. And so the researchers used computer algorithms to simulate human evolution over generations because they wanted to see how these variants would be passed on, and whether they could explain why homosexual preferences are still prevalent, even though evolutionarily they may not be producing many offspring. But what these researchers found is that these array of genetic variations associated with same-sex behavior would have eventually disappeared unless it somehow helped people to survive or reproduce. And so they wanted to, they thought, okay, well, there must be something in these genetic patterns that help people to survive or reproduce in order for these genetic variations to be passed on and to be maintained. And so what they did, they sorted the participants who had only had heterosexual sex by the number of partners they said they had had, mm-hmm. and found that those with numerous partners tended to share some of the markers that the team had found in people who had a same-sex partner. Researchers also found that people who'd had same-sex encounters shared genetic markers with people who described themselves as risk-taking and open to new experiences. And there was a small overlap between heterosexual people who had genes linked to same-sex behavior and those whom interviewers rated as, and this is a little troubling to me, as rated as physically attractive.
Okay. So they're sort of suggesting that those, I guess, helpful genes for survival would have been selected through natural selection. That's why the genes sort of been passed
right.
on.
Right. Yes. And so they're suggesting that the traits such as charisma and sex drive could also share genes that overlap with same-sex behavior.
Okay.
And so this could explain why these traits are maintained and they're passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of dissenting voices, and mostly they're saying, look, you just haven't got enough to show that this is true. It's questionable whether they have, once they've broken down all the data into the different groups, it's questionable whether they have a statistically significant amount of that data, even though there's 500,000 people that they surveyed. And sexual behavior and reproduction occupy sort of different places in modern societies than they did for our ancestors. For instance, mm-hmm. people might engage with more sexual partners now that sexual transmitted diseases can be cured. The existence of birth control and fertility treatments negates many of the reproductive advantages that genes may provide. And there are a lot of other voices probably you haven't got time to go into, but this is, I find these links where we're trying to show there's some genetic reason for homosexuality or heterosexuality, I find them troubling because it seems to be a much more complicated picture than here are a few little markers, and maybe that's what they're saying, but it's certainly not a simple genetic picture. I think we can
probably
say that.
Yeah. I think perhaps they're trying to simplify it, but yeah, that's fascinating.
Yes.
We're going to have to end it there, but thank you so much for chatting. Hopefully we'll be back in the studio sometime soon.
I hope so.
That was Frances speaking to Marcus Jones for this week's Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.